Hey everyone, welcome to Manufacturing Hub. I am Dave. This guy over here is Vlad. If you guys are new here, welcome. If you guys have been here before, welcome back. If you're new here, every Wednesday at about 4 o'clock East Coast time, Vlad and I have a conversation with either him and myself, as we will today, or with a guest, most of the time with a guest, about all things manufacturing and automation. Every month we pick a theme. This month we're talking all about consumer processed goods. Vlad and I are going to go dive into it today, talking about a bunch about our food and beverage manufacturing backgrounds. So excited to go ahead and jump into that. Vlad, do you want to say anything to our listeners at home?
No, I think it's going to be a good conversation, Dave. I'm looking forward to it. We have a couple of notes prepared, so I hope we can hit most, if not all of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely happy to go ahead and do that. As we're kicking off the new theme today, talking about consumer processed or consumer packaged goods, we wanted to give a bit of an overview. So what is CPG, right? So it's a lot of food and beverages, as you guys have heard us talk about. It is beauty, it is makeup, it is all of your personal care and hygiene products. It's all of your household cleaning products. It's basically all of the things that we use all of the time that we are going to go through and use fairly quickly. There was some kind of thought on my side, Vlad, as to, you know, have we gotten to the point where fashion is quick enough that fashion is CPG or cell phones and other consumer electronics? Not quite yet. And so looking at a couple of trends, as I was looking, I think there are a couple of big ones that Vlad and I might touch on a little bit today, and we'll certainly touch on more going forward, right? Talking about evolving consumer preferences, right? So between the health and wellness, sustainability, we've talked a lot about sustainability on this show, especially with our Siemens groups and our Phoenix Contact groups in the past. And we see a lot of rise of e-commerce. Now, Vlad, I was at a mall last weekend for the first time in, I don't know, probably about a year. Apparently I go to a mall about once a year. I'm not sure I've ever been to a more depressing place than the outlet mall close to where my parents live, because about 20% of the stores are closed and the ones that you walk in look post-apocalyptic. Like they're missing 60 to 80% of the things that I see, because most of us just go buy things online and have them shipped directly to the door. And then a couple of other kind of interesting topics, talking about trends. We talk a lot about data-driven marketing, right? So we talk a lot about data-driven manufacturing and sustainability on this show, but talking about how consumers are going and making choices and how companies are literally leveraging those choices and going and marketing so it hits everyone with very specific ads. When we go to websites and Amazon goes and pushes things like that and everything to one's cart. We'll talk a little bit maybe today about consolidations with mergers and acquisitions, right? We see a lot of that, and I think we'll see a lot of that going forward. And then another kind of interesting point on this list of trends is technological innovation, right? So talking about automation, talking about robotics, which we talk a lot about, talking about artificial intelligence, which hopefully Vlad will let go by at this point so we don't derail this conversation completely on does artificial intelligence exist or not, and then manufacturing and logistics and a bunch of other things along those lines. Vlad, any of those things particularly stand out that you want to talk about immediately?
Well, I guess maybe not necessarily out of that list of topics, but I think we need to have a discussion maybe on a more fundamental level of what CPG and let's call it food and beverage industries are, right? For those who are maybe not have worked in those factories and kind of what are some of the general KPIs or metrics that are important. So if I can start us off in that, I want to say segment, Dave. Mm-hmm. So as you've mentioned, we all buy products, whether it is food, whether it is drinks. And typically the channels that you would do that is either at one of the larger chains, right? So I bundle like Costco, Sam's Club, what else? A couple of like the larger chains, Walgreens, and then smaller suppliers, right? And typically what happens as a manufacturer, you would be either selling or fighting for, I want to say, shelf space mm-hmm. in one of those stores. And if I want to again, jump ahead a little bit of the point I'm trying to make. One of the most important aspects of working at a facility, or one of the most important metrics, is how cheap, or I guess like how inexpensive of a product you can make in order to sell that to one of those companies, right? So to give you an example, I've worked in, diverse food companies, one of which was Kraft Heinz. And so every year, or at least on a quarterly basis, you would have a review of essentially what was the cost of delivering that. In my case, it was a Lunchable that I was fairly closely tied to. What was the cost of that package delivered to the distribution center of the customer? And like I said, that could be a Target, it could be a Walmart, Walgreens. And then obviously they would somehow distribute to the smaller suppliers. But I think, again, like at a fundamental level, you're always fighting for that shelf space that we're all familiar with, and you're always trying to bring that cost down from the manufacturer standpoint. And I want to make sure maybe that, like I said, people who are not involved in food and beverage understand that nuance, because I know, let's say if you work in oil and gas, the parameters that you're working with and against are to some extent different. But we can certainly dive into a lot of the topics that you've mentioned as well, Dave. So I'll let you kind of continue on that introduction path.
Absolutely. So I think that was a good introduction. If you guys have questions or thoughts when it comes to CPG in general during this or during any of the other conversations over the course of our theme, please let us know. Vlad, one of the things I want to do before we get too deep into this is we ask all of our guests for their background and their introduction. And I feel like unless you and I are up on a main stage, we don't necessarily do a very good job of introducing ourselves. So, Vlad, can you tell all the listeners at home a little bit more about you as Vlad the practitioner?
Sure. So I guess I'll start from my electrical engineering degree, which I got back in 2013. I immediately went to work for Procter & Gamble at a factory out of Maine. So there we were manufacturing all of the Tampax products. So as you can imagine, highly automated space. And again, we'll kind of get into the nuances of, let's call it pharma or medical device classification of those items versus food and beverage, but highly automated. Pretty much everything was state of the art. I was bringing in different lines from Japan and Italy, where we would essentially commission them and then bring them back to the US for testing and running purposes. I then switched over to the food and beverage industry, joined Kraft Heinz back in 2017 as a maintenance manager. And so there I had a fairly different role, but still overseeing a couple of different lines, working with mechanics and electricians, trying to make sure that production is running. And as I've explained a little bit, that we optimize the cost of production of those goods. And again, I know this is not generally a business podcast. We can certainly get into those numbers a little bit more and kind of what goes into that cost in general. But at the end of the day, my role was to make sure production is running and that we did so with the minimal expenses. That plant ended up being shut down due to the merger between Kraft and Heinz. It was, again, a long business story. It was acquired by a investment firm called 3G. And so they've merged Kraft Heinz back in 2015, and they've decided to close down a number of plants based on performance, strategic locations, being closer to distribution centers. So I joined a smaller systems integrator / contractor that had me go and install different, first of all, automation solutions, but also data applications at various Kraft Heinz, Post Holdings, and a few other customers' locations. So I traveled quite a bit over, 2018 to 2021. And then I decided to go back to school to get my MBA in order to learn a bit more about the business world. So I've since then graduated with a little bit more knowledge under my belt on the business side. And since then, I've been running Solus PLC and then a few other ventures, but ultimately still fairly closely tied to understanding what manufacturers are doing, talking to a lot of engineering managers, directors, and sort of helping them solve problems. And at this point, across different industries, but still predominantly food and beverage, since that's where I've had the most experience in many, many years. How about you, Dave?
Absolutely. No, I think it's always interesting. So thank you for that, Vlad. We'll have to remember episode 152 is where we last did these introductions, so we can just go direct people towards them. But no, hey, everyone, if we haven't met before, my name is Dave Griffith. I've spent the last 15 plus years in automation and manufacturing. My technical background is in aviation and aerospace. And so I've got to spend some time working in that. And then I worked for a large German OEM that builds gantry style machines that drill and rivet airplane fuselages together, which was interesting and kind of my first foray into working with German and European companies. And if you guys listen to the show again, we've certainly done a lot of that here on Manufacturing Hub. About 8-ish years ago, I transitioned out of working in hardware, mostly process automation, to running a systems integration company. We focused mostly on MES, the manufacturing execution system, and kind of data level. And I feel like that's where Vlad and I first connected, and kind of some of the very early beginnings, and maybe the first theme of this podcast was based on manufacturing intelligence, because it very much aligned to a lot of our backgrounds. And then about 4.5 years ago, I tell people, or I joke with people, that I became a reformed integrator and turned into a consultant. So I mostly spend about half of my time helping end users go solve problems, taking technology they have and focused on the execution side of that. And I spend about half of my time working with brands, companies looking to grow and expand, companies looking to come to the US, kind of a variation of all of those. And along the way, I've done a fair amount of work in food and beverage. As Vlad told everyone, he's got a bunch of work with kind of like major corporations. And I've done some of that with major kind of Fortune 50 organizations, but the majority of the work that I've done is on the more small to medium side. And I want to go kind of transition into some of those stories, Vlad, because I feel like here during your introduction, you talked about Lunchables. And I want to tell everyone the first time you told me you had done Lunchables, right? So this is, I don't know, almost 100 episodes in to Manufacturing Hub. Vlad and I were at Automate last year. We're going up. We are in the elevator, going to the hotel, and Vlad like deadpan tells me that he's like, yeah, like, you know, did Lunchables during one of these stints. And I'm like, Vlad, how has it taken almost 3 years for you to tell me that you've done Lunchables? Like, that is immediately something that everyone knows. That is like, I'm like, Vlad, you should lead with that. Tell everyone that you... I joked with him and told him he should tell everyone he's the creator of Lunchables. Maybe don't do that, Vlad, but can you tell us a little bit more about your background and a couple of maybe large food and beverage stories?
Yeah, absolutely. We do have a comment. Let me maybe pull that up really quickly before we go into my story. So Ethan, he's actually working on some Solus PLC content for us that's still nice, to be released. But he's saying, I used to work in a poultry processing for a local supplier. To me, I was an electrical maintenance tech at the time as one of my first jobs out of school. I worked there for a few years, building a lot of industrial experience. My main tasks involved keeping production running, helping with production startup, servicing a wide range of process equipment, including scales, conveyor systems, batchers, graders, baggers, and box machines. So this is, you know, when he lists all of that equipment, at least I pretty much know what all of those are. I don't know, David, if you have like the same feeling, but it mm-hmm. immediately resonates with a food processing facility for me. And I have not worked in poultry. I've worked with some of the cold cut plants for mm-hmm. Kraft. They use a very similar, I imagine, process, and they actually did process turkey, but it was at a later stage. It wouldn't necessarily be, I'm assuming he's talking about the very early stages of poultry processing. It is not the nicest smell, I can tell you that much. That's my yes. experience with any meat products whatsoever. But maybe to transition us to the story, unless you had some comments for Ethan,
I was going to say poultry is like probably the second worst smelling place and types of places that I've worked with in the past. Pigs are, especially in the summer, are in my experience worse than poultry. But Yeah, pigs are worse than poultry, but I think you get a lot of that with live animals. We've got Hank in the comments, and for some reason, I am seeing, like, again, like 30% of the comments when it comes to the chat here, guys. So I'm seeing Hank greeting us from Dallas at Tracer Root Con. I've actually never said that out loud, so hopefully I am pronouncing it correctly, Josh. And we've got Scott McNeil in the comments.
Trace Route Con.
Sure. We got Scott McNeil in the comments talking about paper. I know Scott has worked at some of those paper plants. Those I don't think smell all that great either. Scott, you'll have to go. Let us know.
Dave, I'll say I don't see any of those comments, so I think it's going to be up to you to bring them up. It seems like they're not getting into a restream either. So if there are comments, please bring them.
Absolutely. Up. Absolutely. We will absolutely do our best with comments here, guys. You guys keep commenting and doing all of those things that you do. And if you guys are listening to this afterwards or watching on YouTube or somewhere else, most of the comments that we get are on the LinkedIn side. That is where we get most of our listeners. But Vlad, we somehow completely took you off the topic of a bunch of like very iconic craft foods. So tell us about that.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, to make the story a little bit personal, I wanted to maybe talk about the transition going to from, you know, P&G Tam brands or Tampax into Kraft Heinz, right? And so one of the first, I want to say, glaring differences is that P&G has a system which is essentially a modified, it's a modified Lean Six Sigma methodology called IWS, and you can do a Google search on this. It's a fairly popular system that allows you to optimize plants, right? So in many ways, it is your daily direction setting meetings. It is your root cause analysis tools. It is your, you know, like 5S, which again are somewhat rebranded and created by P&G. And so Kraft Heinz had actually purchased the system for their facilities, but they struggled quite a bit to implement them. And for me, that was maybe the first glaring, I want to say, difference between how the business itself operates. So when you get to a P&G facility, depending on the level, you can immediately see a lot of data and a lot of sort of information about how well the plant is performing by line, by shift. So you'd have a lot of the charts, not necessarily all digital, but a lot of, you know, like the drawings as well. And so when you go to a specific line, you could see how well it's been doing. In food and bev, I find that it's still a little bit, and again, we'll get into the whole argument of maybe slimmer margins on the food and beverage side, but you don't see as many, from what I've experienced, tools of that nature in the facilities of that size, right? So that's the first kind of impression that immediately hits you when you transition, and I would assume from pharma, it would probably be very similar. They're slightly looser standards, I want to say, although the FDA regulates both plants, you know, that I was in. So I think it still is like factory to factory specific. From the automation side, this was my perspective at least, but a lot of the facilities are not cutting edge. Let's put it that way. So you're going to find a lot of fairly old equipment that runs, that still runs, has been probably, you know, refreshed over the years, but ultimately requires a lot of retrofitting to bring it into the state where you're able to pull that data out, right? And so in a lot of my, I want to say, jobs after P&G, I was essentially the guy that worked with a lot of data. I really believe that understanding a system well before you can tweak, make changes, or improve the process is essentially the first step, right? And so in many of these food and beverage facilities, just as Ethan described, you have fairly standard sets of equipment that are, I want to say, brought in from different manufacturers, but ultimately operate in a similar fashion. So in order to extract that data, you don't need to always reinvent the wheel. You need to have a set of formats. And again, that depends on whom you're working with, but you should be able to fairly easily be able to gather that data out of each machine and then pull out the first metric, which is ultimately OE, and then start pulling out some more data out of those machines. But to go back again, maybe to my story, what I've learned is that there is not a or at least the factories that I've been to, there's not always a culture of using data to make the decisions, mm-hmm. whether it is on the engineering side, on the maintenance side, or even on the business side, right? And so I had many, many discussions with engineering managers, directors, to sort of instill those tools and those capabilities. And I think it's one of the biggest opportunities, at least that I've seen, when it comes to, I want to say, less mature industries. So be able to extract the data, which, like I said, requires the upgrade of equipment, which also requires a cultural shift, which also requires the right tools and partnerships, and then ultimately requires you to use the data that you have, which is a whole other conversation. And Dave, I know you've worked in that sphere. So teaching or training the individuals that the data is valuable, teaching and making sure that the data is adequate and accurate, and then making sure that they actually are solving problems that they find on the production floor. So anyways, maybe to wrap up the story, I think that my impression was generally that there's a lot of opportunity in leveraging data, but there were some problems, or I guess some issues, that needed to be addressed in order to get the food and beverage plants up to speed to using it correctly.
Absolutely. I would say for all of the larger organizations that I worked with, I think they very much kind of fell in line with your comments, Vlad, right? They don't have the oldest, or they don't have the newest equipment, and they are not investing in cutting edge for a variety of reasons. And we'll go talk about those a little bit more. And there is the need to go through a culture change if a group wants to be data driven, right? Like most groups, at least especially the big ones, are so large, and they've got dozens or hundreds of employees many times in these facilities across three shifts or five shifts running 24/7, that you can't go in and say one thing to a single group and then suddenly it happens, right? Like if you want to go roll any tool out, you have to go cover all five of those shifts. And it's always difficult, because everyone likes to blame third shift, right? So if third shift does something that sets first shift back, then you completely hear about it, and it's difficult to go get folks who are working on that facilitation. Many times, if it's internally, it's going to be your engineers and your maintenance managers to go cover those third shifts, to go cover those weekend shifts, because it's difficult, because most of those people have worked lots of years in order to work a semi-reasonable weekday work shift. So I would completely agree with that. Coming back to you, Vlad, and kind of your story, when you talk about kind of the differences between some of the P&G groups that you've worked with versus some of the food groups that you've worked with, do you think it's the industry that people are working in? Do you think it's the fact that it's always been that way, that these large Fortune 50, Fortune 20 organizations, why do you think they're different on the Kraft Heinz side versus, you know, some of the more regulated industries, if you will?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. And number one, you know, I don't want to paint the picture that's maybe the reality at every P&G facility. Mm-hmm. I think that, as I've explained, there's, you know, the IWS system, which is Integrated Work System. And so ultimately what that means is it assigns a different level of maturity to a specific facility, right? So it's possible. So I was at the highest maturity level facility, and I've also been to, so for example, Gillette has one of the highest ratings as well. I've been to that facility, and then I've been to some of the diaper facilities for P&G. And those are extremely well automated, but mm-hmm. there are facilities that are not at those standards, right? So I also want to make sure that I put the caveat in that it's not necessarily that every facility is mm-hmm. Running to that degree of efficiency. That being said, maybe some of the reasons, well, number one, and I think I've mentioned this a little bit, is I think there's, so if we go back to what I've described on the business side, right? So when you create this finished good, right? So for example, it's a box of either it is, if you're selling beverages, it's, you know, 12 bottles. If you're selling Lunchables, we have like packs of 8, packs of 10. So that goes on a pallet and gets shipped to the distribution center. In the most, I guess in most cases, what you're getting to the retailer at is going to be 50% of the customer cost, right? So what I mean by that is, if I am, for example, making, you know, Vlad's barbecue sauce, and I'm selling that at $1 to this distribution center, they're selling that at $2 at their store. But as an example, it takes Vlad, I don't know, 80 cents to produce that bottle of barbecue sauce. So the margin is then 20 cents per bottle of barbecue sauce, which again, the costs are going to be maintenance. They're going to be building upkeep, whether it is rent or, you know, amortized over 20, 30 years that you've purchased. All of that doesn't matter. I guess like the point I'm trying to make is there's 20 cents of margin for Vlad's barbecue sauce to make a profit on that can then be reinvested into whatever else Vlad wants to improve the facility in. But in the medical device space or the pharma space, the margins are much larger from what I've seen out of that same dollar, right? So for example, if your bottle of barbecue sauce, the cost to produce is 80 cents, in case of some of the medical devices, I don't know the exact number, so don't go searching for them or fact check me on this, but it was something along the lines of like 5 cents per product that then sells at $1 that then retails, you know, at $2. So obviously the margins are very different between those products. And I think that that ultimately means that you can reinvest a lot more money into sort of the engineering workforce that would then be capable of automating those processes a little bit better, maintaining those processes, running at a higher efficiency, maintaining that OE level, you know, close to or, you know, slightly above 85%. And so that's what ultimately in my mind drives a lot of those different factors. It goes back to retrofit. So you have sort of the financial bandwidth to deploy those projects with a little bit more certainty than you otherwise would.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. I'm going to go share a story of kind of the much smaller groups. But first, we asked in the chat, in the comments, what are some of the best and worst places that you've worked, thanks to Ethan talking about poultry. Ethan actually, I think, says that wastewater. He's worked at a couple of really bad smelling plants there. Hank in the comments is talking about bakery and chocolate plants are really good. And he said he worked at a yogurt facility that smelled like hot jam all the time. That would be good. I have done work at chocolate facilities in the past. Those are generally good. I worked with a couple of those large automation upgrades. Very interesting for that. And then Scott McNeil in the comments is saying Smithfield, the hog processing plant, smelled like barbecue and death. And as I said in the comments, one, I wouldn't like that because I like barbecue too much, and two, that generally fits most of the Smithfield plants that I have been to over the years, especially in the summer. Those first days, if you are working in the summer, are a very easy, are you going to make it at the facility or not make it at the facility? And seeing that this is not a family show, but seeing as that we have some amount of rating in here, probably can't share all of those, can't share all of those stories. We've got someone whose name I don't see, and I apologize, guys. They just show his user up here saying, feeling super grateful about only smelling metal right now. Yeah, the smell of metal is certainly tame and calm compared to some of these things, but no, so I really appreciate. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Vlad.
I was gonna give, I guess, like two of my personal like examples on that side. So number one, that meat processing facility, right? Like I think I mentioned it a little bit earlier on the cold cut side. I remember for the first time that I walked in there with Paul, and I had to hang on to the rails because of the smell of the meat, and sort of the you could see the large chunks of meat, you know, dropping into this grinder, which essentially, you know, like just like big teeth that like come together, and you could see like the splatter of that chunk of meat that just like, there's blood going all over the place. I don't know, it was very repulsive. I couldn't eat cold cuts for a while after being at that facility. And then number two, to your point, like on the heat side, so picture rural Georgia, you know, it's middle of the summer and we're installing this peanut roaster and we're trying to run this thing with like, you know, full blown heaters so that it could essentially like break in the chains. You need to make sure it stretches like entirely, and then you can regulate it based on that. And of course, I'm the only one who's wearing the right PPE that is like fire rated and electrically rated because I have to check the panels. Everyone is almost shirtless because it's just so hot in that room. I'm sweating. The smell wasn't that bad, right? Obviously, there's a bit of a burnt smell, and sort of the metal and the hoppers are, let's call it, cooking a little bit, but it's just so hot and sweaty, and it's just not a pleasant environment. And plus, this was a new facility that didn't have any ventilation control set up yet. So it was a tough couple of weeks getting that roaster up and going.
I worked with a guy a couple of years ago who didn't really have manufacturing experience. And so when springtime hit at the facility that we were working at, of course, there was no HVAC in that processing area. And we were mostly making beer, right? But there was no HVAC. And like 15 minutes in, he's like, he basically taps out. He's like, it is too hot here. I am sweating too much. I could not possibly work here. And I looked at him and I'm like, my man, it is only going to get like this. This is tame. If a warm 75 or 80 degree day in March is going to bother you, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. But having said that, I really liked your examples, Vlad. I want to kind of give the maybe nearly counterpoint when it comes to working with some of these smaller and medium-sized facilities. So as most people who have listened long-term know, I have found a bunch of work in beverage, right? And a lot of work in beer and a lot of work in like hard seltzers and things like that. I've worked with, I don't know, six or eight groups in the last handful of years who all generally fall in that category. And so you guys heard Vlad talk about having automation and all of this. One of the smaller groups that I worked with, they were a brewery. I went in to go look at a packaging line that they had bought. It had lived in a storage unit for, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, but they had bought it. And so we came in to go give it a look and see what we could do to get this bottling line up and running. And we opened the panels and it's literally full of rat poop, right? And so you know it's good when no motors run, when things are wired incorrectly. And as we get deeper and deeper into the week, apparently the story was with this thing, Vlad, that there was a lawsuit because it was promised, and this was like the prototype or the first one that was supposed to have been made, and it never ran. So at one point we ran a label on it, and at one point we ran water through it, and we were pretty sure it was the first time anyone had ever put a label on a bottle when it came to that. And so it was insanely expensive to attempt to get up and running. To the best of my knowledge, it never got up and running because it needed like, I don't know, $20,000 to $30,000 worth of upgraded and new things. But for that group, it was worth the gamble because they were in a, call it, approximately 7.5 barrel brew house. If anyone is in beer, that they know how small that is. It is exceptionally small. And whatever they wouldn't put in kegs, they would quite literally go and like a couple of days a week, there would be two guys who are literally hand bottling this, right? So it comes out, they've got a couple of bottles, the bottles get washed and rinsed and flipped upside down, and it's a like 80 to 90% manual process. They hand fill it, and then they go manually put the tops on with nitrogen. And you have never seen a couple of guys with bigger forearms than like 2,000 bottles in. They're like 12 hours in.
Regular bottles?
Like 40-ounce bomber bottles. Yeah, okay. Like big bottles. But they're doing literally everything that wasn't sold out of kegs for the front of the house was done with that. And then kind of on the flip side, I spent a bunch of time working with a mid-sized co-packer brewery. They had a 150 or 200 barrel brew house, so significantly larger. They had thousands of barrels of tanks, And as they were going and becoming a co-packer, that they quite literally bought what they called this Frankenstein line. So they bought a filler and they bought a cartoner and they bought a tray packer and they bought a pasteurizing tunnel at some point that they literally ripped the line in half in order to go run this pasteurizing tunnel through. And they had this sleever machine that was just absolutely horrific to attempt to use. But like for them, that was the first step of automation, right? So that was the first step of automation. And I don't know how many millions of dollars it would have cost to get that in. That was the first step of automation. And they were going through a $50 to $80 million increase where they were getting a couple of new lines in, because that was going to prove what that looks like, that it was a viable business. So as much as Vlad and I like to joke about the organizations who have been around and may not be the most automated, I kind of wanted to give that counterpoint to our listeners who might not know how, I don't know, advanced some of these groups are who have managed to put juice or beer or whatever it is into containers day in, day out, because there are groups who struggle to do kind of those most basic things.
And Dave, let's go on a slight tangent since you did mention co-packers, right? And I don't want to make the assumption that everyone that's listening and viewing us necessarily knows what a co-packer is and ultimately maybe how those dynamics fit into some of the business decisions, but also some of the automation decisions. So could you give us maybe like a first pass through of like a co-packer, and I'll maybe give some comments as well.
Absolutely. I will. We'll tell the listeners that we will go kind of talk a bit about co-packers. We're working to confirm a guest to come on about specifically to help us deep dive into co-packers. But a co-packer or a co-manufacturing facility, I see it a lot in CPG. I see it a lot in food and beverage, but they work in a variety of other places. It is a facility that will, to your specifications, go and make your product and then package your product in their lines, generally to the best of their ability. And they typically run much smaller. They typically run much smaller batches, right? So if you're a beer group, right, you're Anheuser-Busch, AB InBev, you're running millions or tens of millions of the same Bud and Bud Light and the other items that you're going to run in these facilities all day, every day. But perhaps you're looking to try something non-alcoholic, or perhaps you're looking to try something that is much more difficult and not within your standard standard specifications. You might go to a co-packer and say, hey, can you guys make this for me? And I only want 20,000 or 50,000 cans of this, and we're going to go ship it out and see how it works. And you would get a price for that. Or on the flip side, where I see there's lots of opportunity, is let's say Dave and Vlad have an idea and we want to make a particular beer and we want to put, I don't know, coconut flavor and peanut butter and some other wild stuff. And we're like, oh, this flavor will be absolutely great. But obviously we're not going to go brew the beer in our backyard and then go hand can or hand bottle it. So you go to a co-packer with your recipe, and then with that recipe and some art and some logos and things like that, they will go through the process of making it for you. And typically it's an all-inclusive price. So if you charge per can or per six pack or 12 pack or tray, there's typically a price in there. There's typically a price in there, and it is how lots of small to medium groups are going through the process of getting their stuff made today.
Yeah. And if I can add to that on the larger group side, right? So the example that I gave of the peanut butter facility was actually a co-packer. And so ultimately it would receive orders from small and large companies. And so for the large companies, it could be, for example, an increase in demand during certain peak seasons. So for example, for Lunchables, when it was back to school season, that's when they ultimately had a lot more sales versus during, let's call it, the spring or the summer months. And so they would use a co-packer to balance out or to buy the extra cases that they needed in order to make their production or I guess their sales worthwhile. But mm-hmm. otherwise, you're then sitting on an empty facility that's not running because you have a specialized product and you're not going to make that for anybody else, right? So that's kind of the trade-off for a high value or I guess like a mature brand, because if you have it in-house, then you sort of protect the IP. If you send it to the co-packer, then ultimately they have some access to the formula or recipe. But on that side, you don't need to maintain that equipment. They can run your recipe, then they can run somebody else's recipe, and it doesn't really matter. Obviously, there's going to be contracts in place for them not to steal the recipe or, you know, the labels or the brand, and you would be generally protected. And then on the flip side, like you've explained, if we want to start a bottling facility, we probably wouldn't do it in our backyard, but we could also, you know, estimate, well, that's going to take $10 million. We go to the bank and our operation, they're going to ask us how many pallets you're going to be producing. And it's going to be, you know, a pallet a week. And they're just going to tell us pretty much you're not going to get a loan. You're better off, you know, getting this made by somebody else. So there's also sort of the financial aspect of it just doesn't make sense to open a facility for such a small production. That again, this would not be like a three shift operation. It would just be us running that for a couple of days. So you would turn to a co-packer that has an established production line and bottling line and, you know, capper, filler, label, or what have, and palletizer and what have you, so that you could essentially run it at a cheaper cost. And so I want to say that the common, or I guess the common sense or the best case scenario math is that you sacrifice a little bit of your margin in order to still be able to sell the product just as you would from coming out of your own facility. But the reality, at least in my experience, is a little bit different, right? So there's going to be a couple of different pitfalls and sort of gotchas when it comes to co-packers. And I think that ultimately everything is negotiable, but there's costs associated to and I'll give like one specific example. So the requirement on the craft side is that you have metal detectors for each line that you're running, you know, your peanut butter jars on. So ultimately what Kraft had negotiated with the co-packer is that they would install their own. So Kraft would provide the metal detectors. And when you're running Kraft peanut butter, you would have to pass them through the detector and then sign off on a report that that is running. Ultimately, that is someone's paying for that machine, and someone needs to maintain that machine, and someone needs to integrate that machine. So you're ultimately putting a piece of machinery from your requirement into a co-packer, and then it becomes a bit more muddied as to what the agreement looks like, right? So there's there's a lot more nuances, I think, than me and you are able to probably explain even in like a 1 hour conversation. But everything is possible, and there's trade-offs and sort of costs to all those options.
Absolutely. And then I would say we are very specifically talking about food and beverage here, but we see co-packers kind of across all industries. There are some major groups who make sense for them to have manufacturing internally and intrinsically, because that is part of their core competency and they get all of this extra benefit by owning all of the manufacturing and being able to increase or decrease production or try new things. But I think lots of smaller brands, you don't possibly have the opportunity to do that. So I will go ahead and shout out. So for listeners who don't know, I like notebooks, right? And so this is a notebook that I listen to kind of the guys talk as they went through the process of making it. And I get to laugh because they talk about the struggles of manufacturing and the lead time of manufacturing and all of these other things. But for most groups, like you couldn't afford to go buy the raw materials, go buy the embosser, go buy kind of everything you need, and then have it stitched or glued or other things together, right? That is not feasible. So you go and you build a product based upon different offerings that people have. So you pick the paper, you pick the cover, and then at some point it meanders down their processing lines and they go make, if it's 500 or if it's 25,000 of these, and that is a day, a couple of days, a couple of weeks of production for them. And then they've got another 6 months of product that this group is making. So there are lots of kind of very specialty products that unless you're one of the largest organizations, you can't, or you're super small and make everything by hand, there's kind of this large middle ground that for the vast majority of groups doesn't make sense for them to even attempt to go make themselves.
Interesting.
So I want to go touch on a topic, Vlad, that you had talked about a little bit before, and it's margins, right? And I think that is the thing that very much, I think it's the thing that kind of bridges the gap between large companies, between small to medium-sized companies, between almost anyone, unless you make like hyper-exclusive, hyper-specific, exceptionally premium products, there is not a ton of money per item in nearly anything food and beverage related.
Right, I would definitely agree, right? And as you said, unless you have a premium product or a differentiated product, or I think the third one would be a branded product, it becomes very difficult to compete on that market, right? Because at the end of the day, a beer is perceived as a beer unless there is some kind of a very different, let's say, sought-after profile, but it's going to be very difficult to sell that to a consumer at a bar at a premium, right? So if it's $6, maybe there's a way to stretch that to $8, but it's not going to sell for $60 per se. Versus if you look at a trademarked item or a highly, I want to say, differentiated item like Lunchables. And even so, I think Lunchables got copied by a bunch of different brands that, again, just repackaged food. And I think they took over the market quite a bit. Or if you look at even, I think Gillette was a very massive brand for P&G in general. And then the biggest, I want to say, news on that side was when, there was like a service where you could pay a couple of dollars and then you get a razor.
I think it started as Harry's, right? I think Harry's was maybe the first one. There are so many different razor companies.
I think it was Dollar Shave Club.
Dollar Shave Club.
That's right. So essentially what they had done, right, and I think this is a business case, if I'm not mistaken, in a couple of journals that was published, what they did is ultimately they reverse engineered what it takes to create a razor. Then they opened a couple of facilities that have much lower regulations overseas. And then the costs of shipping those razors were significantly lower than the cost of producing those razors in the US, right? So the current Gillette facility is in Boston. And so ultimately going back to my point on, you know, what's the cost of product produced at a factory really matters even as an automation engineer, because ultimately whatever equipment you put in goes against the calculation for that product, right? So ultimately, and again, not to get like too lost in the numbers here, but if you choose to automate, that has an inherent cost of increase on that specific piece of product. And the higher the cost, the more difficult it becomes to compete in the marketplace, right? And so, again, if there's not a huge differentiator, if somebody else can come in and create that same product or I guess like a differentiated brand, and essentially squeeze out that shelf space that you would in CPG or food and bev.
Absolutely. And I think I remember one of the shave companies said basically how they purchased a facility. And so they were manufacturing their own items. And I don't remember if it was Dollar Shave Club or if it was Harry's or some group that said this, but what was I going to say? And their kind of claim to fame is we basically cut out the middleman, right? So instead of stocking it on store shelves, at least to begin with, they sold direct to the consumer and they took out two or three or four levels of we're going to go double in price for our value add. So that's how a $1 razor turns into an $8 razor when you go buy it at the store, because the company makes it, they sell it to a distributor who puts it in a warehouse, who sells it to someone else, who puts it on the truck, who puts it in the store. And suddenly our $1 razor becomes an $8 razor, with a bunch of different hands that touch. And so I think the direct to consumer marketing, I think the direct to consumer opportunities are certainly very interesting. And that for them is one of the ways that they were able to go. Well, in theory, they probably made a little bit more money, but they also cut out a bunch of layers in there. So the company as an organization made some more money throughout the process of that. But no, I would generally agree there when there are lots of hands that touch this, there is not all that much money there's not all that much money that goes around. So I have done a bunch of work with some orange juice facilities. I've done a lot of use with some orange juice facilities, and some of them are really into like the 5S. And I one of them that I worked with had this really interesting thing, right? So there were four or five kind of major components of the orange juice going into a bottle, and the bottle being sealed and the label getting put on and that going to store. And I was actually surprised how expensive it was, right? Like it was not quite $2, but it was really close to $2 as of, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, the last time I looked at it, as just straight manufacturing costs without labor added in, right? So it might be $2 or $2.50 by the time it leaves the facility to go to the warehouse to sit before it goes and it goes on shelf stores. And there are lots of times where you can go buy orange juice for $2, $3, $4 a container, depending upon where you are and what type of year it is and all of those things. So to me, I look at it and I'm like, man, those are fairly slim margins for a large company to go make this. And the only way it makes sense is if you go do tremendous volume, hundreds of millions of, yep, of gallons or a billion gallons. I don't even know what the orange juice market looks like beyond a lot.
Yeah, and exactly. And I think that's the difference between, you know, if you look at the other extreme, which is pharma, they have patents on their specific products. And again, rightfully so. We can also discuss, if you go look at their financial statements, they have a lot of R&D and they have other costs associated with, let's call it, getting to that patent. But when it comes to their margins on manufacturing that specific product, it's going to be extremely high, right? Because nobody else, Dave and Vlad, cannot come in and manufacture. Again, I don't know what are some of the newer drugs, but we could probably not make aspirin under that name until, if I remember correctly, there's like the generic after, I think it's 30 or 50 years when it becomes available. But anyways, that by that time,
I think it's like 7 to 10 years is that when... I think 50 years is like written books.
Oh, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Right. But anyways, like the point is they have a patent that protects them. So there's really nothing that can be done. You cannot sell it. You cannot produce it. You can maybe do it in a completely different market where they haven't patented it. But that's a whole, other conversation. But the point is they can have those high margins because they have the product pretty much secured by the R&D that they have put in money up front into.
I think that pharma accounting is a lot like Hollywood accounting, in which no matter if a movie makes $18 million in the box office or like $3 billion in the box office, they always say that they lose money. I think the accounting is very similar. So Mark Cuban, a year, maybe 2 years ago, I forget the name of the company. I'll go ahead and Google. He came out with like a generic drug company where he's got a bunch of off patent drugs, anything that he can go make a generic of. And I think they're selling it for like $20 a prescription or $25 a prescription. Let's see.
Of any drug? They just like manufacture whatever is off.
Yes. So the company name is Cost Plus Drugs. And if we hold up here, so I guess that they've got, so their concept is like literally no middlemen, no price games, huge drug savings. There is a lot of words here. There's a lot of words here, but they offer, affordable medicines at the lowest costs available. And it's their mission, their opportunity to go and attempt to reduce the cost of drugs. And if you guys give me a sec, I will go ahead and throw this in the chat. But no, so I find it interesting. I think that the cost of pharmaceuticals in general has gotten absolutely insane.
Pure operational efficiency, is that what they're trying to achieve here?
It's a brand new facility, right? I don't know if Mark is necessarily attempting to go make money or make a bunch of money off of it. I mean, the dude sold a company for like $2 billion to Yahoo like 20 years ago. So I don't think, like, at some point you don't need the money, and there is huge value in doing things like this. But no,
I will say,
go ahead.
I was going to make the comment, you know, like when it comes to, I want to say, of brand things, and I'm not saying that generics or even like this company is doing this. I think that, you know, going back to my Gillette versus Dollar Shave Club example, there's also something to be said about the quality of product when it is, let's call it, manufactured at a reduced cost, right? Like there's nothing, how to say, there's nothing free, let's call it, in this world. So typically what you'll see is, and I'll give this example because I know my mom worked at Neutrogena, so I had many conversations about solar creams and protectors and sunscreens and sunblocks, and she's a chemist on those. So ultimately what happens is, you know, Neutrogena has a very stringent process on how they would produce those products and how they would test them. There's quality control labs, and they will ensure that the product before it gets to the consumer is going to be adequate for, let's call it, human use, right? And you can certainly find cheaper alternatives. So if you go to Walmart, Target, or any other of these stores, then again, Dave and Vlad can also come up with their own soap and shampoo. But the chances of us having the same level of quality and control and ultimately maintain the same margins and provide the same type of shelf space is going to be relatively low. What I mean by that is it's not all made equal. So there's going to be trade-offs with using off-brand, or I want to say like lower cost products, that I think consumers are not always aware of. And I think this even goes back to our conversations on co-packers. The reality is a co-packer's, and again, this is my experience, is never going to be able to make a product to the same level of quality that you can in general in-house. It's going to be rare that you have a very set up process in-house that runs well. You give the same recipe to the co-packer and they're going to have the same level of quality of production. So there's also, I think, Dave, wasn't it you that was telling the story about the sneakerheads that would like check the ID of like who it's made and then like...
So we had a guest on, Adam Montoya, and I'm trying to get him back on. I don't know what his schedule looks like for this, but Adam is the sneakerhead, right? And so he on, and I'm going to have to go look up the episode that he was on. I don't particularly have it off the top of my head, or maybe Vlad will look it up while I'm retelling the story. So Adam was on one of our episodes, and he's a sneakerhead, right? And so he really likes sneakers, and he was saying how in the sneakerhead community, the specific facility that a sneaker is manufactured at makes a difference, right? So like a facility sneaker might be worth $50 or $500 more if it comes from one specific facility, because the quality from that facilities are so well known. And Vlad looked it up. It's episode 61. So thank you for that, Vlad. It was a really good episode. Adam does a bunch of work in that. He talked about reshoring the Mac Pro, which was super interesting all the way around on episode 61. So certainly worth a listen to that. And so I think the deeper you get into any specific hobby, that is where kind of quality is super worth the extra prices.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. Let's get us back to food and beverage, because I feel like we're focusing on a lot of different tangents. But so utilizing co-packers, then we also wanted to talk about build versus buy. So I guess I'll maybe start off with a perspective and let you continue, Dave. So again, going back to my experience at PNG, pretty much every machine that we had on the plant floor was designed in-house by a team of engineers from ground up, including, you know, every mechanical aspect, every process and automation aspect. But when it came to food and beverage facilities, in most instances, because again, products are fairly similar, chances are there's, you know, thousands of bottling facilities, a lot of solutions for whether it is cutting your slices of meat or cold cuts, whatever it is, packaging, you know, barbecue sauces. Those machines already exist and they come at a fairly low cost compared to what you would pay if you were to redesign that from scratch. And I don't know why you would, but I guess what have you seen mostly or predominantly? Is it groups creating their own machinery or doing something very custom versus just buying off the shelf solutions?
So I guess I see a lot of groups not necessarily intending to reinvent the wheel, but I see a lot of kind of like reinvention of the wheel, especially groups that don't have kind of that strong engineering, strong operational background of this is how we've done it in these places before. And if you don't have that background, then it becomes, we're going to go buy the things that we think make sense. And again, I've been to facilities that they literally had to cut the line in half, pull it 25 feet in either direction, and put a large piece of equipment in the middle because we just never considered having to do that. It is the extreme example of Vlad's metal detectors at the peanut butter facilities. And I will say, Vlad, I don't know if it's also your experience, but I've heard from multiple people who do work at peanut butter facilities that, like, I don't know, once every 2 to 4 weeks, they get a call because someone has somehow managed to encase the PLC in peanut butter and someone has to go clean out the PLC and reset a bunch of things because the PLC is literally full of peanut butter, which to me is just like the most wild thing ever.
I've not had that experience with PLCs, but it certainly happens to like pumps and sensors and augers and like belt feeders, because what happens a lot of times is you're sending peanut butter through pipes and it's not that the pipes burst, but usually either the pump fails or, you know, there's an area where it cools off a bit faster than it should. And so then there's going to be like a spill all over the the flow meters don't function. That was actually a very big learning point for me. I remember we had brought in like a specialist in flow meters, mm-hmm. and obviously they're all rated for liquids. And so peanut butter, depending on its temperature, is not a liquid, which makes it very difficult to control from, you know, like a pure reading the flow meter reading and then like controlling the pump that's upstream. And so to your question, Dave, like what happens then if you inaccurately restart the line after the peanut butter has cooled down and now the reading is incorrect coming back from the flow meter into your control system, you're going to force too much product through and chances are either the pump's going to cavitate or it's going to cause a clog or like a burst downstream.
Absolutely. Ethan is in the comments again talking about how peanut butter is the best way to liquid cool the PLC. I would also say in my experience, the only people that consider peanut butter a liquid in all states is the TSA, who will not go let you take a container of peanut butter in your checked bag, regardless of if it's open or not. Very much upset, Beth. Very much upset,
really?
Beth.
I brought jars. I filled up like jars of peanut butter into my checked bags and
So you can put it in your checked bag. You cannot put it in your carry-on. Like you cannot carry it through for a carry-on because they consider it a liquid.
Right.
Vlad, this has been awesome. Do we want to go ask each other our normal wrap-up questions for the listeners?
Yeah, let's do it. What do you have? What do you have for the future, Dave?
So I predict the future is we're going to see a lot more co-packers. I think we're going to see the rise of a bunch of groups who are investing in a bunch of technology and are leveraging that technology to go solve problems as you and I were talking. And I think as we go look at a large number of, I think as we go look at how quickly consumer packaged goods are moving, we will continue to see the rise of new brands, the need to go rotate things through quickly. And so hopefully we'll see some more onshoring when it comes to that, so that we can go print 50 t-shirts or 1,000 t-shirts and not have to order 50 or 100,000 t-shirts and hope we get the right sizes and then have them shipping containered over from China or South America or somewhere else. What are your thoughts, Vlad? What do you think the future looks like?
I continue to harp on data. I think it's becoming cheaper and cheaper to get signals into a control system, whether it is then after passed on to a SCADA or a proper, you know, historian. That remains to be seen. I think that the opportunity is also, and I say this a little bit differently, I think, than most people, is not an AI and ML. I think the opportunity really is to, number one, rectify your networks. I think in most facilities, you still have either like a fully flat network or a non-existent network. It becomes very difficult to extract that data. And then ultimately just putting in something that can collect the base signals at the facility, I think that's a huge win for many manufacturers, many engineers to understand a little bit better what's going on with the process to then start tweaking, to either optimize or troubleshoot. So I think that data is, you know, despite the talks that we're hearing in many of these trade shows that you and I go to, I think is still at a very not resolved stage. I think there's a lot of solutions that can help you pull OE, but I think that, at least in my conversations, very much so, we don't understand the process at a deep level or at a level deep enough to be able to make decisions, to be able, you know, to tweak a batch, to be able to change certain parameters and then have a predictable outcome at the end of that shift or run.
Absolutely. I think that is a good prediction, and I hope we certainly do get more data driven in the future. Career advice, Vlad. So outside of, people should go get a subscription to solusplc.com to learn all of the hardware, all of the robotics, all of the everything else they need to do. What's your career advice?
Yeah, so I've been listening to, you might know this guy who stood up a lot in the Apple cases when they were trying to close down the access to repair, the rights to repair. And he talks a lot on YouTube as to like why that's important. But anyways, the career advice, or I guess the point that he makes, is you should reach out and sort of ask for advice and ask for, let's say, guidance and help when you're stuck, right? So what I mean by that is when you're, I think, early stage in your career, you sort of feel this pressure to need to figure everything out on your own. And most engineers are not going to reach out to either their peers or someone that they feel is, you know, very high up above them. And so my advice for engineers or those in their early career is to not be hesitant to reach out for help and ask for guidance, advice, or support.
Absolutely. I think that that is fantastic. I would say kind of in addition to that, have an idea of what you want to do in your career and be happy and willing to go ahead and say yes and do your very best to put yourself first in lots of situations and make sure there's a reason why you're going to go do things, right? There's lots of opportunities. Make sure you're asking to go to training classes. Make sure that you are asking to, you know, change different positions within a facility or look at potentially changing industries and get as much of that experience as you can, because in 5, 6, 10 years, you will have a large depth and breadth of that experience, and you can be much more in control of your options and your career choice. Vlad, thank you. I'm going to ask for a book recommendation, because I feel like if I ask you for a content recommendation, you're going to list everyone like 1,000 podcasts that you listen to. So you got a book recommendation for us today?
So the book that I guess has been pretty interesting for me in the last couple of months. It's called Fanatical Prospecting. It's on the sales side of things. Again, you and I have discussed this many times outside of the podcast. I think that the process of sales does not come naturally to anyone, and it probably takes a lot of learning and mistakes, but you can certainly get the the best practices and I guess a kick as well to get started in the book called Fanatical Prospecting. I don't know what the author is, but I think it's what's also important to recognize is that sales is not unique to trying to, I want to say, coerce someone to buy a product that you have. It could also be in the sense that, you know, you've described to sell your bosses on your ability to go to a trade show or to a class or, you know, mm-hmm. to even hire somebody under you to hire help. So I think it's a very important skill in many different aspects. And so fanatical prospecting, if you're looking to figure that out,
awesome.
I'll have that posted in the show notes.
Perfect. Now. So I have three books that I'm currently in the process of failing to get through. So I'll go ahead. So two of them have been recommendations already. So I have Atomic Habits by James Clear from the library. It is interesting. I'm still kind of going through that. I know it really works for some people. And so I'm kind of working my way through that book. On the flip side, we had Adam on last week, and Adam had the Culture series. So he suggested this strange sci-fi culture series from an author named Ian Banks. And I have had it in waiting to get through some of the other books in order to go read. I have not started it yet, but it is in my library from the library.
Bible?
I did not get the iteration of the Bible. No. But again, I did get the first of the Culture series, called Consider Phlebas. We'll go with that. And then I last week was listening to a podcast that I sometimes listen to, and the author of The McKinsey Way was given some highlight notes about the book. So I have acquired that book, but it didn't show up until like Sunday night or Monday morning. So it is quite literally still sitting in the Amazon box next to my desk.
Are we going to get a live unboxing?
I maybe we could do a live unboxing. At some point, I don't know. I might tape it and then show it to people if it's good, but not show it to people if it's not good. So we got a couple of books that are all slowly in the process of needs to be read. Vlad, beyond that, let's go ask you the last question is, how can our listeners help? Who do you want to connect with? Any and all of those questions?
Well, I guess currently my biggest needs are technical writers and creators on the topics of PLCs, HMIs, SCADA systems, robotics, predominantly FANUC, but KUKA is also an option. Also in the realm of DevOps and SRE programming. So if you want to create content on any of those topics, if you want to just create content and build that out for me, then let's talk. Other than that, I'll be at Automate. So I'm going to be hopefully connecting with a bunch of people from the industry. If you're going to be there, happy to chat. Whether you have an application that I can refer you to someone, or if you're just looking to talk to a fellow industrial automation enthusiast, happy to take a moment for that as well.
Awesome. I love that. Let's have a follow-up question. Vlad, will Solus PLC have stickers?
That is still a TBD. I have not put any of the creation
steps in motion. I have this entire board, and there are zero Solus PLC stickers. Zero Solus PLC stickers.
Do you have any Chrono stickers?
I don't. Does Chrono have stickers?
No.
Okay. It would be super disappointing if they did. So everyone message and harass Vlad till he gets stickers. There will be Manufacturing Hub stickers because I know the guy who presses the order button for those, and he'll go order another 1,000 because I think we gave the first 1,000 away.
Will there be a second version like with some cool things?
I am considering, typically I wasn't thinking about doing this live. I was considering going and taking the yellow and turning it into some sort of like sparkle glittery background. But having basically getting rid of the yellow and turning it into something sparkly, because but
then they need to be like a special, it has to be like a limited edition, you know, like a special event one. No,
I don't know. I'm not to that point of special event stickers for Automate. We are still at least 2 months away. But before I consider that, but no, on my side, if you guys want to reach out and chat, I am always happy to chat. If you are an end user who is looking for help because you've got some sort of operations and technology issues, I would love to go talk about that to see if there's anything I can do to help you with that. And beyond that, if you're a brand, looking to grow in the US and want some of my technical practitioner knowledge and kind of path of how we can go ahead and do that, give me a call. Always happy to chat. Vlad, with that, we've somehow managed to already fill up 75 minutes. Let's tell everyone thank you for coming to hang out with us. This has been an awesome conversation. Super excited to continue down the CPG path all month long. We'll be back Wednesday, same time, same place. If you're not following Manufacturing Hub, please follow Manufacturing Hub, follow Vlad, follow me. Always come hang out in the chat. This is super amounts of fun. If you guys have made it this far and you're listening on podcast form, please do the like, subscribe, rate us 5 stars, share all of those awesome things. When I ask and we remember to go post these, you guys do it, which is super awesome. Until next week, we'll talk to